This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. I form light and create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things. These are the words of Isaiah 45:7 and are probably some of the toughest words in the Bible for people to digest. The Lord creates calamity? Well, how should we understand that? And what does that mean in our own day when we see global calamity of all kinds? And maybe they're on the increase as well as we head further into the last days. Well, joining me now is Joel Richardson, author, editor, director, and producer of several documentaries and host of the online Christian program, The Underground. His book is called The Mystery of Catastrophe, and we're really glad to have you with us. Joel, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very good. Thanks so much for having me back on, Janet.
Well, it's always nice to talk to you. I'm interested to hear how this book came about. I see a lot of books and a lot of subjects addressed pertaining to our trials in the Christian life and suffering in the Christian life. You're talking about catastrophe, though, so that's a whole nother level of bad things going on. What brought this about?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I've co-authored this book. My co-author, Nathan Graves, he's just this rock-solid veteran missionary. He's been working in Albania for 24 years. And as you know, my emphasis over the past few decades, has been the Muslim world. Well, as the refugees were pouring up through the Balkans, roughly a million, you know, Syrian, Afghani, Iranian refugees. I know you're very conservative. I'm very conservative. You know, I was aware of the fact that this is a catastrophe for Western Europe.
Yeah.
But despite that, Nathan and I got together and we formulated a project whereby he gathered together. I sort of did the fundraising on my side. We raised close to $100,000. And he gathered all sorts of different evangelical leaders throughout the Balkans. And what they did is they put the Bible in multiple languages on micro SD cards, along with a lot of different Christian literature, as well as the addresses of ministries in Europe, Western Europe, that said, we want to actively engage these refugees and try to reach them with the gospel. So as they were pouring through, they set up these checkpoints. They would do free cell phone charging, which, of course, the refugees needed. And they would offer, they would say, listen, we have these micro SD cards. It has the Bible in your language. Would you like us to put one in your phone? And about 95% of them said yes. And so despite the catastrophe that was unfolding, we tried to look for the gospel opportunity and to make the most of that opportunity. And as a result of that initiative, there are dozens of new believers now spread all throughout the Balkans.
Good.
As well as in Western Europe.
That's good. Well, when you're talking about catastrophe, you talk about, for example, in the book, the biblical foundations. You see a lot of catastrophe, for example, in the Old Testament, and you see what the Lord did to Egypt, for example, when he said, you know, he wanted Pharaoh to let his people go and the plagues came and all the rest. But we are seeing in our own day, for example, and I know you discussed this in the book, the aftermath and the ongoing issues pertaining, for example, to the Syrian civil war and all of the refugees that have been created for that. But that was just awful. I mean, the whole issue with ISIS and the terror that they were spreading throughout an entire region and Christians being displaced and Christianity being eradicated. Where are things right now, Joel, pertaining to the existence and proliferation of Christians in that region? Is it the case that Christianity continues to subside, or where do things stand right now?
Well, a lot of the original Christians, you know, many of them are from the Chaldean Catholic, you know, churches, the traditional churches. A lot of them obviously are leaving because of persecution. Some of them are still sticking it out. But what we're seeing in, for instance, in Lebanon, in Jordan, where a lot of these refugees have come to, you know, stay as displaced peoples, roughly 2 million in Jordan, 2 million in Lebanon, about 3 million in Turkey. there is an abundance. Roughly 50,000 new Protestant evangelical believers that are former Muslims. So,
really?
They're, you know, look, in the midst of the catastrophe, and I don't want to deny the fact there is a catastrophe unfolding, the Lord is always about the business of redemption. And this is what we're trying to get people to pay attention to, is to say, Lord, what are you doing and how can we partner with you? The closer we get to the return of Jesus, the more these catastrophes and crises are going to explode across the earth. How can we partner with what you are doing in the midst of it?
Yeah, that's such an important subject, Joel. When you talk about catastrophe and the biblical foundations of catastrophe, I had quoted at the outset Isaiah 45:7, which is always a shocking verse to Christians who haven't really heard that verse before. The Lord creates calamity. They like to think that the Lord just is in his heavens and he just showers down nonstop blessings all the time, all day long. Yet we're in a sinful world. We know that. And we know what the Bible says about previous catastrophes. How do you see the subject of catastrophe through a biblical lens?
Well, you know, ultimately the big picture is that God is about the process of, you know, this process of redemption. He's ultimately going to, you know, at the conclusion of the book, he says, behold, I make all things new. And, you know, that doesn't mean he's not going to cast a multitude into the lake of fire. But the end result is there's going to be a renewed earth, and his glory will cover the earth as the waters cover the seas. So we have to understand his end goal. And if he has to use catastrophe and crisis to further his ultimate long-term redemptive goals, he will do that.
Yeah.
You know, we have a theology of blessing, but very few in the Western church have a theology of catastrophe, especially a mission of catastrophe, a theological mission of catastrophe. And we have to develop that if we're going to navigate the days ahead.
Can you explain that a little bit further? Because that is very interesting to me, the theology of catastrophe. What should we know about that?
Well, I always like to just use examples because it's easier to sort of wrap our heads around. You know, we look at the story of Joseph. His brothers sold him into slavery. We know the story. Well, on the front end, you know, if you say, hey, God is in this, people are going to go, what are you talking about, Joel? You're trying to say God supports human trafficking?
Yeah.
God supports slavery? This is ridiculous. You don't understand God. You don't know what he's like. You don't understand the Bible. But if you follow the story to its conclusion, you know, there's famine, and the brothers end up down there in Egypt, and he reveals himself, and he goes, hey, guys, listen, what you intended for evil, he doesn't say, God redeemed what Satan did. He goes, what you guys intended for evil, God intended for good, ultimately for your salvation. So we have to understand that God is always, you know, 100 steps ahead of Satan. And even Satan, and this is a difficult thing, but even Satan is still God's devil.
Yes,
even the Antichrist is still God's Antichrist. He is sovereign over all of these things, and he has a larger goal of redemption, and he will accomplish that.
Yeah, that's such an important point. You think of the flood, for example, and yes, the world was wiped out, but for Noah and his family, but that was also about redemption. That's a perfect picture of redemption right there.
Yeah, absolutely. We understand it on an individual level. You know, God allowed, you know, maybe this tragedy to happen in my life or this difficulty. Maybe he allowed me to lose my job because he wanted to humble me. He wanted me to learn dependence. We can understand those things. But when they happen in a large-scale manner, for some reason, again, especially Western Christians, we just have a hard time accepting that God could actually be in these things. And the fact is, the scriptures give abundant, you know, proof that he actually is in these things.
Yeah, and that says something about a mystery. When you talk about the mystery of catastrophe, I think that's also a mystery for us when it comes to the character and nature of God, because we tend to think of God in our Western world in this little way, and God is not allowed to be mysterious, and yet who is more mysterious than the Lord? He's revealed himself, but there is also much about the Lord that we will never understand, because he says his ways are not our ways.
Right. You know, you quoted that verse in Isaiah, and, you know, there's another one I think of in Deuteronomy 33, where God, he says, I'm going to allow in the last days, I'm going to allow Israel to come to the place of the end of her strength. And then I will say to her, where are your gods now? Where are your idols now? And he goes, behold, I am the one that brings death, and I'm the one that brings life. I'm the one that strikes, and I'm the one that heals.
Right. Joel, hang on. We're going to take a quick break. I want to get into The Mystery of Catastrophe, the name of the book from Joel Richardson and Nathan Graves. When we come back, diving into more about the last days, the context, it's going to be interesting. Stay with us on Janet Meffer Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. As Christians, we see the encroaching pressure on us to accept every demand of the LGBT movement. Christians are banned from social media for talking about homosexuality as sinful or sued for not baking the cake. It's bad enough to see this in the public square, but this sinful movement is now making its way into our own churches to change our theology, as evidenced by the recent Revoice conference. It's time for the church to take a bold stand against the attempted queering of our churches before they are theologically destroyed from within. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the upcoming God's Voice Conference, February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City. You'll learn how sexual radicals are working to undermine our churches and how to stand on God's Word. And you'll be encouraged by the testimonies of Christians who've been set free from homosexuality by Jesus Christ. It's time to hear God's voice. Come stand with us at the God's Voice Conference, February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City. If you register by December 31st, you'll get a discount. So go to godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Glad you're here and glad to be talking with Joel Richardson. His new book is The Mystery of Catastrophe, Understanding God's Redemptive Purposes for the Global Disasters of the Last Days. Let's talk about the last days. This is, Joel, you're very much your wheelhouse. And when we talk about the increase in lawlessness and the increase of birth pangs, as Jesus discusses in the Olivet Discourse, how does catastrophe fit in with the picture of the last days according to Scripture?
Well, one of the issues that I spend a lot of time on in the book is what I believe is going to be the greatest catastrophe that will ever befall the earth before the return of Jesus. And the reason I believe that is because that's exactly what the angel Gabriel said, and that's exactly what Jesus said. He says, this will be the worst thing that has ever happened, the worst tribulation since the time that there was a nation until the end, and this is ultimately the tribulation that will be brought about by the Antichrist. So we're talking a global persecution against Christians as well as Jewish people in the last days. This will be the greatest. And so even with this, you know, and this book really, I kind of call it an equal opportunity offender because on one hand, you know, I'm offending those that say, hey, don't talk negatively about Islam, don't talk negatively about their theology and, you know, this sort of thing.
Yep.
And I definitely go there. I go, look, you know, Islam is an antichrist theology. It's an antichrist system. We need to be honest about that. On the other hand, it also offends those that are sort of just stuck in that place of anger and bitterness regarding Islam and say, but despite that, we are called to imitate our master who allowed himself to be mutilated, who allowed himself to be murdered, who allowed himself to be killed in order that he could cause his enemies ultimately to become his children, of which we all once were. And so it's a harsh look at reality. You know, there's been more martyrdoms, more persecution in the earth in the past couple of years than at any time in the history of the church.
Wow.
And yet despite that, we are called not primarily to take up arms, not primarily to, you know, bomb this country or that country, although, you know, there's a place for that, for the governments and so forth. Our job is to have a gospel focused. How can we win radical Muslims? How can we win moderate Muslims to the gospel? How can we share the gospel with them? And so it's about having a gospel-centered mindset in the midst of all of this chaos.
Oh, yeah, we have to. But when you say, Joel, in the book that Islam is the primary instrument the Lord will use to bring about the coming great tribulation, unpack that a little bit. Tell us how you see that to be the case and how it could potentially unfold. Why Islam and why focus on Islam in that primary role in terms of the spirit of Antichrist?
Yeah, and there's a handful of reasons, and as you know, I've written a lot about this in the past. In the book, I deal with some of the biblical reasons, but also just some of the real-world reasons. There's been a few different studies done, Open Doors and a couple of different Catholic organizations the past few years. You know, as I said, there's been more persecution of Christians in the earth in the past few years than at any time in human history. And the overwhelming majority of the nations where this is happening are Muslim-majority nations. So, you know, this sort of rise of radical Islam that we see in front of us, it's happening already. It's happening already. Maybe not in the United States, and therefore we don't pay quite as much attention to what's happening in Nigeria or northern Iraq or this sort of thing, but it's already happening. And the thing of it is I'm not a huge fan, but I cite Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She's the one that wrote this book on the five stages of grieving.
Yes.
And I say, look, much of the church today, they're in this place of denial. You know, it's already right in front of us. The evidence is right in front of us, but we create these different mechanisms. The charismatic church tends to go, well, this great revival is just going to sweep the Islamic world, and the threat of Islam is going to go away. Within the prophetic segment of the church, they sort of have these scenarios, Psalm 83, Ezekiel 38, 39, they go, oh, Islam's going to get wiped out. You know, it's just going to get wiped out and Islam's going to go away. And I go, none of these scenarios work. Radical Islam is here to stay until the return of Jesus. And it doesn't matter, by the way, Janet, I lean toward a post-trib or a pre-wrath perspective on the rapture. Mm-hmm. My co-author is pre-trib. And so this is not an issue. It really doesn't matter what we believe with regard to the rapture. The bottom line is these things are unfolding now. They're unfolding, right now, and they will continue to unfold. So regardless as to our view on the rapture, this is a eminently relevant book for our day.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I thought it was fascinating the way that you talked about the fact that the Islamic prophecy really mirrors biblical prophecy, but the difference is they're on the wrong team. They're on the wrong side. This is something that I think still a lot of Christians don't understand, the 12th Imam and all of that theology. But just briefly, Joel, can you explain to people how you see the unfolding of Islamic prophecy in tandem with biblical prophecy, how they see it versus how Christians would see it unfolding?
Yeah, well, in essence, in a nutshell, the Bible says in the last days there'll be two primary satanically empowered bad guys. That's the Antichrist and the false prophet. And then, of course, one good guy, that's Jesus. He comes back to kill them and defeat their armies and undo their occupation of the state of Israel and the persecution that they'll be accomplishing throughout the earth. Well, from the Islamic side, they have two primary good guys. The first character is known as the Mahdi, or we could just say the Mahdi, and they believe that he'll have an assistant known as Jesus, or they say Isa, the Messiah. And so they are actually, they're looking for two end-time figures that if the Antichrist and the false prophet were to emerge, they would actually fulfill the expectations of Islamic prophecy. And so in many ways, Satan has set up the Islamic world to receive the Antichrist, to receive the false prophet, as if he is there, as if they were the primary Messiah figures. And then alternately, Muslims believe that this charlatan, this Antichrist, sort of comes back, and he will claim to be Jesus Christ. He will claim to be the King of the Jews. And so it's an anti-parallel. It's this mirror image. And Satan has used, and he will use, the false prophecies of this massive world religion to ultimately fulfill the purposes of God. And like I said, Satan is ultimately God's devil. And, you know, this isn't what, you know, in the Western world, we think just Oprah Winfrey is going to send out the email and everyone's just going to sign up overnight for some new religion. It's just going to happen overnight. And I go, you know, once we understand the Israel centricity of the story, you just look at a map, you go, Satan has been surrounding the state of Israel, the throne of David, for the past 1,400 years.
Yep.
It's right in front of us.
It is right in front of us. And you always have the saber rattling and you have, you know, literal bombing and literal killing all the time going on in Israel. When you talk about the fact, Joel, that Americans are largely not aware or maybe not paying attention to what is going on in the rest of the world pertaining to the advancement toward the Great Tribulation, what about Israel? What can you tell us about the current situation in Israel and the signs you may be seeing in Israel that the Great Tribulation is, who knows how imminent it would be, but what are you seeing in Israel that is giving you pause and maybe helping you see a little bit more clearly where things are headed?
Well, in Israel, they're, you know, increasingly stronger by the year. There's a sense of confidence in their military. And listen, it's understandable to develop a strong military, never again after the Holocaust. But what I see developing throughout the nations, and just put this in context, you know, you think before World War II, before the Shoah, before the Holocaust, you primarily had one entity, one nation that was spewing Jew hatred. But even much of that Jew hatred, that anti-Semitism, it was largely said behind closed doors. Today, we see genocidal, open hatred of the Jewish people being spewed, not from one entity, but from hundreds of nations and peoples and ideologies throughout the earth. It's spreading throughout Europe, throughout the West. It's acceptable. You know, even in the UN, it has become mainstream. And so, you know, we have recent history in terms of an example of what mankind is capable of. You know, what we would have believed to be a very civilized Western European nation is capable of committing a genocide. We see this just, you know, brazen, overt Jew hatred spreading throughout the world, as well as this demonic lust to possess the promised land. So there's the hatred of the Jewish people, the demonic desire to possess the promised land. The scriptures make it clear that all the nations will ultimately gather together against Israel and Jerusalem. So what more evidence do we need? And yet, you know, we look back at the German church, we judge them, we say, man, they sure failed. And yet, by and large, we have all of this evidence that something is on the horizon. And for the most part today, the church is doing almost nothing about it.
Goodness. Well, and you mentioned when we talk about catastrophe that in the Olivet Discourse, we will certainly see more of that. Do you see a rise in natural disasters and catastrophe in keeping with Matthew 24?
Yeah, and this is interesting because some people will say, well, these things are cyclical. You can look out throughout history and these things have always been. But we actually cite quite a few different studies and facts and statistics in the book, and we show that they are indeed increasing. Both natural and man-made disasters are increasing in our day. And so Jesus uses the analogy of birth pains. Anyone who's had a baby or whose wife has had a baby know that these things increase in frequency and intensity the closer that we get to the day. And so likewise, the birth pangs are now increasing and spreading throughout the earth. And I believe that's primarily for that final period of the tribulation, but nevertheless, even in our day, we see them increasing. And so, you know, it's, you don't have to believe in global warming to believe that these natural disasters are increasing. And I believe that the closer that we get to the return of Jesus, the more that these things will hit full throttle.
Very important. The Mystery of Catastrophe, the name of the book, Joel Richardson with us. Always good to talk to you, Joel. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Janet.
All right. God bless you. And we'll be back right after this. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how things pan out, given that federal judge's decision about Obamacare being unconstitutional. We told you about that just a couple of days ago. What do you think this ruling will mean for the future of Obamacare? That's one question. But also, what about the future of choice in paying for our health care? We're going to get some thoughts on it now from Matt Bellis, who is Communications Director at Liberty Health Share, a national nonprofit health care sharing ministry. So good to have you here, Matt. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Janet. Doing well.
Well, good. I'm glad you're here. What did you happen to think about this decision from this judge striking down Obamacare? I mean, that was quite a decision. It had a lot of people excited, but what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I had two thoughts, actually. One was, well, it doesn't affect me.
right.
Being a part of Liberty HealthShare, it's something that we've already taken care of, and doesn't really affect our members, so to speak. But, you know, it also just kind of made me a little bit sad that here we are again, waiting with bated breath to know exactly what some disaffected third party thinks about our health care.
Yes.
And it made me say, I'm glad that I'm in a place where I don't have to worry about it. I'm free from it. It's something that I've already taken care of. And for those who are on the sidelines waiting to know what's going to happen with the law, it frankly makes me sad. It makes me a little angry, too, but it's just unfortunate.
Well, it really is. And for people who are not familiar with how Liberty HealthShare works, can you outline for people how it is that you can pay for your health care costs, but in a completely different model than people are used to with private insurance?
Sure. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded people who are voluntarily sharing medical bills with one another. And so that means that every single month we have members all over the United States who are sending money to other members who have needs. No different than if you were to go to church one day and stand up and say, hey, everybody, I have a medical bill. Here's the bill right here. Can you all help me out in paying for it? And people come up and give you money.
Right.
That's basically what we're doing, just in a more systematic, thought-out way.
Well, right. Now, how does it work when you sign up for Liberty HealthShare? I know that you have something called a share box, and people are not familiar with how that works. But walk us through a little bit of how you get your costs shared, as you just described.
Sure. If you go to the doctor or hospital, you're going to have a bill. Because you showed your Liberty HealthShare membership card to the doctor and hospital, that directs them how to process the bill through Liberty HealthShare. Then when you go online, you see where Liberty HealthShare has for you called a share box. That's just an account that we have for you as a member of Liberty HealthShare. That's where our giving and our receiving is done. And so you see where your monthly share amount goes out and see who it goes to every month. And then just like you have this medical bill, you see all of the share amounts come in and help pay for those medical bills that you have. So it's a very simple process, very easy. It sounds conceptually different, but really it functions in the way of somebody's life, how they normally take care of their health care bills.
Right.
So
Liberty
HealthShare is there to make it easy.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about continually has been the fact that many, many people have switched from insurance, especially in the age of Obamacare, to health care sharing ministries like Liberty HealthShare. What do you hear from your customers about the benefits of doing it this way?
There's a lot of reasons as to why people give us, as to why they have become Liberty HealthShare members. Some, frankly, love it for the cost benefit. Whenever we do healthcare the way that we do it, we often pay a lot less for it. Our members pay a lot less per month for their share amounts than other people do for their healthcare. Some people love the freedom and the position that it gives them to be the true director of their own healthcare,
yeah,
the way it should be.
Yeah.
But for myself and for a lot of others, it really fulfills that spiritual desire that I have to be in regular support to other people who have a need. It really feels good to know that my money is not going down some third-party black hole bureaucracy. It's actually going to help somebody who has a real and significant need.
Right. What about pre-existing conditions?
We handle pre-existing conditions in a lot of ways. Just because you have a pre-existing condition doesn't discredit you or disqualify you from Liberty HealthShare membership. So if you have a pre-existing condition, I would suggest go online, go through the enrollment process. Doesn't cost anything to go through that process. Find out which way we would work with you. And we also have a way that we do a program called Health Track. Health Track is a program for people who have pre-existing conditions that are responsive to lifestyle changes. So people who have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, obesity or smoking. If you have those types of things, we would sign you up for our Health Track program. You're given a health coach, and you work with them on predetermined goals that you set yourself. Once you reach those goals, you graduate from Health Track, and you retain your Liberty HealthShare membership. But again, we take care of it a number of ways, and so I just want to make sure that people get their particular needs taken care of so that they don't have to rely on whatever I say on the radio.
Absolutely. Makes a lot of sense. What about contracts? And sometimes, you know, you sign up for your insurance once a year, and then the next year you have to decide whether to re-enroll. Is that how it works with Liberty HealthShare too?
No, with Liberty HealthShare, once you're a member, you can stay a member for however long that you want. There is no regular contract that you need to sign every single year, and there's nothing that is binding you in saying that you have to do this. Now, that does mean that if you're not going to share in medical bills with other people, that means that we won't share medical bills when you have it. But with Liberty HealthShare, it really does put the responsibility back on the individual, restores that voluntary relationship that we've enjoyed in this country for so long, where we know that to be a good member of a community is not only to receive, but to contribute. And so that's what we're doing as well.
Right. So when you're talking about the hospital or the doctor getting paid, you have a card, right? So you're telling your doctor, I'm with Liberty HealthShare. And then what happens from there?
So you hand your card over to the doctor or hospital. It directs them of how to send their bills in. It shows them what the reimbursement schedule is for that particular medical need. And so doctors and hospitals really enjoy the aspect of Liberty HealthShare because doctors and hospitals get into medicine because they want to help people.
Right.
They want to be a patient advocate almost. They don't want to be a broker for an insurance bureaucrat. They're there to be a part of the healthcare process as well. And members of Liberty HealthShare are able to restore that relationship with their doctor and hospital. So whenever doctors and hospitals see how we take care of bills, they accept it readily.
Well, that's great. And one of the things that I think is so advantageous for members is that you don't have to pay for something that conflicts with your conscience or your religious convictions. And that was such a sticking point, wasn't it, with Obamacare when it first came online, that people said, well, wait a minute, I don't want to have to pay for something that really goes against my conscience. Not an issue, is it, with Liberty HealthShare?
No, and you would probably be horrified to know where some of the money that you send in for your health care goes. And it's something that we would often sound the bell and say, you know, people who have a conscience wouldn't responsibly send their money or give money to an organization that is directly funding something that violates their conscience. And so with Liberty HealthShare, we don't do that. We actually are a part of those things that are unexpected and unaffordable, and we do not share in medical bills that violate the conscience.
Well, that's excellent. And people need to check out the website. It's libertyhealthshare.org. Again, that's libertyhealthshare.org, a national nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry. Find out more at libertyhealthshare.org. Matt Ballas with us. Matt, thank you so much for being here, and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, Janet.
All right. Thanks for being here. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create Enemies Within the Church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. To stay updated about this film and learn how you can support this important effort, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com and subscribe to the Enemies Within the Church newsletter. While you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com, sponsored by Cornerstone World Outreach International. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. I like to read, and whenever I can, I like to read the Puritans. John Gerstner once said that the Puritans constituted the greatest movement in the church since the days of the apostles. That's quite an endorsement. I'd like to recommend a publisher committed to the writings of these godly men. It's called Northampton Press. Men such as Jonathan Edwards, Thomas Watson, Jeremiah Burroughs, and John Bunyan are just a few of the great preachers they've put back into print for us. Many of these titles have not been available since the 1600s, but now they are in print. These books have been retypeset, slightly updated for modern readers, and printed in such a way as to last hundreds of years. I can personally recommend them to you, having read many of them myself. And if you purchase any Northampton Press book and pay by check, they'll send you a free copy of the book Law and Liberty, A Biblical Look at Legalism. For more information, visit their website at northamptonpress.org. And remember, it's N-O-R-T, hamptonpress.org. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Well, there is some good news out of Wisconsin, where a judge has just struck down a restrictive sexual orientation and gender identity non-discrimination ordinance that offered no exemptions for religious organizations. We're going to find out more about it now from Brad Dacus, founder and president of Pacific Justice Institute. Brad, it's so great to have you here. How are you?
Oh, doing great, Janet. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about this ordinance. People have been hearing more and more about this sort of thing going on. But what was the situation in Wisconsin? What went on here?
Yeah, the city council for the city of DePere decided to enact this ordinance, and they applied it to everyone, including churches and ministries. We at the Pacific Justice Institute at first blush thought, well, maybe they just were sloppy, weren't aware of this. And we went ahead and appeared before the city council, presented them in writing explicitly how this was unconstitutional. They still adopted it anyway, would not reverse. And so we had no choice but to file a lawsuit in court there in the state of Wisconsin.
Wow. Well, when they were made aware of the fact that it's unconstitutional to not make a religious exception to that kind of ordinance, what was their reasoning? Did they explain why they did that?
Their reasoning was that there's no room for intolerance there, and they said since churches open their doors to the public, then this is a form of public accommodation. If they were closed door, to only themselves, but since churches open their doors to the public, so they serve the public with the homeless, and since they're serving the public, this is public accommodation. And so, therefore, we as the government get to control and tell them who they can hire and how they can do it and how they have to compromise their deep religious beliefs in Scripture.
Well, wait a minute. How do you have it both ways? Because this is the same group of people, not necessarily in DePere particularly, but the same group of people ideologically who often talk about the separation of church and state. All of a sudden, the church is a public accommodation. Well, then why can't we have prayer in schools?
Yeah. Well, you're right. It doesn't go both ways in the minds of some. But the whole concept of the separation of church and state is actually just this, what we're talking about, to protect the church from the state,
right,
from state control, state dominance, and persecution. And so this is where the doctrine of separation of church and state is really to be applied correctly, and that is to protect churches from the state and from the government. It is very Hippocratic hypocrisy to say It could be used to prevent churches and religious organizations from serving the community and being able to do what they feel called by God to do and to carry out their faith.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about this suit and what this judge just ruled. What was the reasoning and how was the whole thing handled?
Yeah. Our chief counsel, Kevin Snyder, flew in to Green Bay to argue this in court. He's an excellent litigation attorney, and we take on cases all across the United States. We have Pacific Justice Institute when needed, when called upon without charge. So we did that. We made the case before the judge, and the judge saw that this was a violation of the constitutional rights of religious institutions, that the government has no compelling interest, narrowly tailored compelling state interest, to delve into the hiring practices of ministries and churches like they did in this ordinance. It was a very clear-cut decision with the judge, and it was a very decisive decision that hopefully other cities across the country can learn from when they try to show intolerance and invade the church doors and sanctuaries of America.
Well, now, you brought up something really important here, Brad, when you refer to hiring practices, because as I understand it, if this ordinance had been upheld, this would have been the first ordinance in the United States to deem churches places of public accommodation. So hiring practices would be affected. That means you could not necessarily say, I would not hire a practicing homosexual to serve on the church staff. How far would it go, in other words? To what extent would this ordinance have affected the decisions of a church without running afoul of the law?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, for example, let's say you have someone who was working for the church, and their position, say, is in church counseling, or say church music or worship. These positions, and let's say that employee comes out and says, "You know what? I want you to know, I decided to marry someone of the same sex, and you have to deal with this. You know, accept this, despite your beliefs and teachings on Sunday morning." This law would have prevented the church from dismissing that unrepentant employee, and would have basically shut the church down. I mean, the damages would have been horrific and continuous, so that the church doors literally would be shut down by the state inevitably, as this thing carries itself out.
Yeah, well, you know what strikes me a little bit, Brad, is the fact that you cannot say on many levels, I would expect, that somebody who is practicing homosexuality has rights to the church, especially when you're looking at churches having biblical doctrine and going, by what the Bible says on these matters and having the authority to talk about what is sin and what is not. I mean, there seems to be a misunderstanding here that the state seems to think it has the authority to impose upon the church what they believe is moral and tell the church what you think is immoral doesn't matter. I mean, this is really a conundrum here.
Yeah, I try to remind people that when the word tolerance is used, they need to ask, is it two-way tolerance or one-way tolerance? Because one-way tolerance is tyranny, and that is exactly what this city was doing. It's exactly what the government does when they decide to act like this and intervene in church matters.
Right, exactly right. So what happens now with the ordinance? I know that you were representing several churches and a radio broadcaster. In particular, what happens now with the city of LaPierre? Do they repeal it, or what happens now?
Well, it is struck down. They don't even have to repeal it, but I will say this, we're not sure at this point that they are going to accept this decision. We think that, in fact, there is still a chance that they could decide to appeal this case. And, they were very stubborn and obstinate from the beginning. And if they do, then we at Pacific Justice will fight them on the appellate level, the state court appellate level. We're hopeful that that they won't. It's a waste of tax dollars.
Yeah.
But if they do, then we'll take this case all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary.
Well, what do you think when you talked about going back and arguing before the council there? Do they have any interest that they've articulated other than activism for even putting an ordinance like this together? In other words, it seems as if the goal in some respects is punishment. It seems that that's really what drives a lot of this. It's just plain activism. It's LGBT activism. We don't like the fact that there is some sector of society that says that this behavior is wrong and we're going to stick it to them. I mean, that's how it looks.
Well, that's what it is. I once spoke to an LGBT activist, tried to have a constructive, you know, conversation, and I told her, I said, now you guys wouldn't, you know, be in favor of shutting churches down or attacking churches because what they preach about these sexual acts and LGBT lifestyles behind the pulpit, would you? I mean, you would be tolerant for that. And she looked at me straight in the eyes and she said, well, in the United States today, I don't believe there's room for any such intolerance anywhere.
There it is.
And that is the mindset. That is the end game. And that's why we at Pacific Justice Institute are not going to shrink back on these LGBT aggressive issues where they infringe upon the religious freedom rights of others. There are some there in the community that do believe in religious freedom, but the activists that we're talking about that are often behind these city councils, they don't have an agenda of tolerance. Theirs is one of our way, or we're shutting you down into silence and to completely take out those who believe differently. And that's very, very dangerous for those of us who cherish a free society, much less the Constitution of the United States.
I'm glad that you shared that, Brad, because that's what Christians really need to understand. They need to see how far these people are willing to go with it and actually treat the church as if it's akin to the Ku Klux Klan. Absolutely crazy. Well, Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute, you can check them out at pji.org. Brad, always good to talk to you. Thanks for being here. Thank you for joining us on Janet Mefford today. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.